Today's program has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza, robertaspizza.com.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Headphones are turned up loud.
We got it cranked up today. It's punk rock and pizza. Two great tastes that go great together. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Barreling into the holiday season, your favorite time of year.
It really is my most favorite time of the year.
How's the Christmas tree all set up?
No. I don't get it until a little later in the month. I like to power celebrate. So I think maybe like next week, the week after.
Next week and the week after. This is the denouement of the greatest epic of my life.
It's true. This is my only two more shows after today, so we have to let this one, we have to make this count.
It's true.
Mike's firing me.
Yeah, I'm hiring someone with a bigger Twitter following. I miss you already. What a long, strange trip it's been.
Yes, and I'm really excited about our guest's book today because I'm like, this is the first time I saw, this is like my childhood in book form. I love it.
Which is good because in 2 weeks we're doing Judy McGuire, This Is Your Life. So.
Oh, good. I can't wait for that one.
But might as well start now with New York Hardcore. And our guest, Tony Rettman, is the author of the new book, NYHC, New York Hardcore 1980-1990. Tony, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Thank you so much for coming in. This book, I mean, I'm looking at the pictures, and I just remember thinking I was I'm so big. Like, I'm so old in these pictures, and everyone looks like a fucking baby. They all look like, everybody looks like they're 12 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
Is okay. That what happens when you get old? Not that you would know, Tony question? Or Mike.
Judy was full-on hardcore. You were a Mohawk.
I had one Mohawk. I had two Mohawks.
You're the double Mohawk.
I had three Mohawks. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I was a hair person, but I spent every Saturday at matinees and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. That I love the setup too. The the oral biography kind of thing.
That's important to do because you can't futz with it. You know, like there's no way to revise anything there. Like that's everybody's words. They can't come back and say, hey.
Right.
That didn't happen. Well, that's what you said.
You misinterpreted this, and I have the tape.
Yeah, I have actual hard copy tapes. I don't mess with the digital.
So yeah. Old school. So tell us, New York Hardcore, for those who don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Or were too sadly not even born.
Or too lame. Too lame to get into the mosh pit, or frightened by the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because honestly, a lot of my friends at the time, I loved it. I was there at CBGB's at the shows on the matinees and stuff, but... the kids that went there, I didn't see them going to see the Gun Club or the Cramps necessarily or rock and roll bands.
I don't know. I saw that.
I don't know. One thing about the kids, see, that was an all-ages show, and other bands played in bars.
Right.
And opposed to the punk rock generation that came before them, too, the Sex Pistols played in bars. This was an all-ages thing.
Yeah.
It was definitely a youth movement.
Definitely.
And I loved it. I took a lot of energy and a lot of good hard lessons from it.
No, I agree. I think that's something that – it was definitely something that was youth-oriented, and it was, for lack of better words, for the kids. And there's also a thing where, my brother was taking me a lot of these shows, and there was a lot of bands that I identified with, but then there was bands that were like, they were a gray area band where they couldn't play a bar show, but they weren't really hardcore. Like, I remember first time seeing like Flipper and just being like, I don't get this. like where's Agnostic Front? I don't get it. But, it's many years later and,
Flipper being a good example of a band that did have a sort of hardcore DIY ethos.
Yeah.
But they were definitely bit avant-garde, you know, for the thrash crowd, which tend to be a little bit more on the nose with fast parts, mosh parts, and their political message. Yeah. And what the fuck was Flipper? It was like a hippie jam band gone wrong.
It was the Grateful Dead. It was the Grateful Dead of, but, like, noise rock.
But, you know, like, yeah, like my Flipper single, that paid for some utilities one month. That's another thing. Like,
oh, yeah. Let Them Eat, my copy of Let Them Eat Jelly Beans got me a lobster dinner.
Uh-huh. My Misfits singles paid my rent for several months.
And can we consider the Misfits a hardcore band?
Ish.
Yeah. Ish?
Well, a lot of people asked if they were in the book. And in some sort of weird, maybe aesthetical way, I thought, like, the Undead fit in there more than the Misfits in a way. Like, because by that point, from what everybody said and sort of, like, from doing research, like, you know, the Misfits are already on, like, a certain plateau. Like, they weren't, like, going to A7 to see Rapid Deployment or something.
No, I mean, I don't ever remember seeing the Misfits at a show unless they were playing a show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was a different thing entirely. So just to center this for those who weren't there, I would say, and I'm not talking being New York-centric here, but of the hardcore punk movement, such as it was, the Dead Kennedys were the first band that I heard that was, like, sort of like, you know, the post-Sex Pistols era of punk that I really loved. And then MDC was a big band for me. Certainly the Bad Brains were the biggest. Mm-hmm. Minor Threat. Those were the bands that I think were probably the top tier and kind of created the sound that everybody came after.
That's true. But, you know, I think the interesting thing about New York is, I think, when all those sort of first wave bands or scenes like D.C. and Boston and things like that, you know, by 1984, 1985, they were sort of like, ah, we're going to go metal, or, hey, we're going to be like emo core or whatever that came. But then
Boston.
Well, Boston went more metal. D.C. kind of went into the...
They're both lame. This is New York, dude. This is not Boston. This is New York, not Boston.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is I think New York really... That's when it blossomed, when all those scenes went to the wayside. Then you had the Cro-Mags, and you had Agnostic Front, and you had Murphy's Law sort of coming in.
Which are huge. Huge.
Yeah, and huge. And then that, like, New York was the first place to sort of welcome the whole, like, whatever you want to call it, the crossover, metal, what have you. Like, so at that point, they had the spotlight on them when all the first scenes sort of were, like, you know, growing, or, you know, however you want to put it.
I'm happy because there hasn't been that much written about, I mean, not that many books about New York hardcore. There are certain bands that have done okay and stuff, but there's L.A. L.A. always gets all the credit, I guess, because...
What, you mean for the thrash bands? You mean like Orange County punk?
Like, you know, just those... Like the punk scene from LA gets way more books written about it for some reason, and this
even the Black Flag,
Flag, Circle Jerks, all them. I mean, I loved them, but you know, I also loved like Heart Attack.
Yeah.
We were talking about Reagan Youth.
Basically, we're talking about Reagan Youth just to get you to tell our favorite story one more time before you leave, Jimmy.
You can just like Google it, okay? The nose ring getting stuck in Dave's dreadlock.
That's right, Tony. And somehow that didn't make your book.
Yeah, somehow.
Well, that's actually, I met Judy before we actually met, was in a van going up to Boston to a gig with Reagan Youth.
Okay.
And Dave Insurgent was a great friend of mine, a very close friend of mine. In fact, I dedicated my book, I Have Fun, everywhere I go, to
I like
Dave's
how you managed to put the entire title of every time you mention any of your books. That is a
that's
skill.
That's not the entire title.
Oh, okay. That's
that's
okay.
Far from it, my friend.
Can you refresh my memory on the entire time?
I'd more quickly remember the subtitle to John Strasbaugh's book about Greenwich Village. By the way, we're going to see John tonight at KGB Bar. For anybody who's listening who's tuned in a couple weeks ago to hear John talking about the history of Greenwich Village, if you're around, come see John and I greeting tonight at KGB Bar. But Dave was a very good close friend of ours and a very funny guy, very charismatic guy, and a guy who had like some natural leadership abilities in the scene. And that's where I met Judy. She was with her Mohawk climbing in the back of the van when my band Sharky's Machine went up to Boston to do a gig with Reagan Youth.
Okay.
I love the comment in the book. It's true. Reagan Youth was such a loved band. They were clever. They had good hooks. They were kind of political without being obnoxious, which was a big problem back then.
Yeah.
And their record just came out too late, and they missed the whole wave.
Exactly, exactly.
They would have been huge.
No, it's true. And I have a very vivid memory of, you know, I have, again, an older brother that got me into all this stuff, and he would bring home – he worked in a record store, still does – and would bring records home every Friday. And I remember reading about Reagan Youth and, like, Maximum Rock and Roll and stuff like that. And then when that record came out, I remember I was 12 years old, and even I was looking at it like, dude, where this is over. Like the whole fold out, like, right, crass, like crass cover.
Style, but anarchy.
But once I heard it, I was like, this is fucking great.
Well, the great thing about Reagan Youth, I always thought Paul Cripple, the guitar player, was a really great guitar player. Yeah. Those guys were into hard rock. They liked Led Zeppelin. And Dave had a mentality that went a little bit beyond, you know, this hardcore thing. Now, if you remember 1982, while this was going on for all ages shows and this hardcore punk and thrash, across town there was another thing going on, which was the garage rock revival, which was kind of like, you know, it was in a bar, it was a little bit older, it was paisley and very chick friendly, you know. And decided,
but there was a lot of crossover in the crowds.
I don't know how much. I think Dave Insurgent was the guy who really kind of, he kind of embraced flower power, you know, and I don't mean the peace punk San Francisco, you know, kind of thing that was happening a little bit later, but he was open-minded to, like, hippie rock and classic rock, which was definitely 86 on most of the hardcore thrash agenda.
You know, the funny thing is when I interviewed Paul for the book, somehow we got on the subject of the Grateful Dead, and he was like, you know, Reagan Youth covered, like, the other one or something, like, in Chicago, and there were just, like, a bunch of skinheads moshing. And, like, I was like, well, that is sort of the original mosh part. And he's like, yeah, it is. Oh, I never thought about that. Yeah.
Well, if you listen to the record, there are some, like, really ingenious, like, Led Zeppelin riffs worked into their songs, their hooks. And the first drummer they had, that kid Steve, was this little kid. Like, he had great hands. I mean, that really separated them, too. Yeah. And Jerry Williams recorded that record. He knew how to make drums sound great.
Yeah. But there is something a little more punk. I don't mean punk in the way of, like, but there's, for Reagan Youth, I think there's something that musically or sonically connects them more to, you know, there's some kind of weird, like, New York Dolls-y kind of gritty.
Well, he had a 77 stuff. Thing. Yeah. And back in the day, that's what we'd call, if someone played punk rock, not hardcore, we'd call it 77 style.
Yeah.
They loved the Ramones, you know, they loved the Sex Pistols, they loved the Damned very much.
Yeah,
Sham 69 was a big favorite of Dave's, too. God, Dave took me to see Sham 69 one time at CBGB's. At this point, they decided they weren't going to be a punk rock band. Yeah. They were going to be a Depeche Mode-style pop band. Yeah. Maybe you were the same day. They emptied the club. I mean, the club was packed to hear them, you know, do If the Kids Are United and all that stuff. Yeah. And they came out with synthesizers, and within 10 minutes, there was no one left.
No.
I've never seen a club empty quicker. Even G.G. Allin couldn't empty a club that fast.
Well, with me, it was, I grew up in New Jersey, and my brother was a DJ at City Gardens in Trenton.
Another hardcore capital.
Yes. And so, whatever, I guess it's Sham 69, so he was playing, like, old 77 punk rock. And I remember standing out in the crowd, and all of a sudden there was, I forget what record was playing, but you just heard, like, the record skip and, like, hit, you know, just the label. And it was Jimmy Percy knocked it off the turntable and then got on the microphone and was like, you know, this is 1986. It's not 1977. This isn't a nostalgia show. We're a band now, and blah 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 blah.
We've got the now sound.
And then then I guess the now sound was synthesizers, and then there were a bunch of skinheads there, not too happy about that. And
he was serious.
Pick your own adventure. How that ended.
I think they went back to their roots, though. I think they reformed for a while, and doing greatest hits like everyone is, I guess.
Well, nostalgia is a big, not the punkest of them all, Bob Dylan, by the way, whose show the other night was so fucking punk. He's so much punker than you are, Judy McGuire. He's punker than I am.
Yeah. I'm a middle-aged woman.
Okay.
I'm not punk.
Well, this is a 73-year-old guy, and he came out and played songs from his last couple of records.
Yeah.
And that was a show, and he stood there and did it, and wow, it was like, I mean, no, it wasn't a greatest hit show.
Yeah,
I'd like
exactly.
to see Mick Jagger try that.
Yeah, exactly.
To put out a relevant record in the last 10 years, and then base your entire tour on the work you've done in the last few years, instead of, like, going back to the 60s. It was incredible.
No, that sounds great.
And but speaking of nostalgia, that is definitely a lot of nostalgia, I think, for the hardcore thing. Agnostic Front still play, right?
Yeah.
Murphy's Law wheels it out once in a while.
Yeah, but I think the thing is, especially with New York, I think, is it didn't become nostalgia. Those guys kept doing it. Agnostic Front just kept putting out records.
And
that's the whole thing. Is like, there's no cash in here, I think, with a lot of these guys. No one went away and was like, hey, somebody cares, all right, and, like, strolled back in. Like, they were always doing it, and they deserve that respect because they never left.
I think the Nihilistics, did they ever break up? Like,
no. They keep going. God bless them, too.
Go ahead.
No, I was just, like, that band is very important to me in a way that, again, my brother bringing that record home and, like, looking at that back cover of that record where they're just like, whoa, like, they look, this is radio, but they look like this. And just
picture
look at
a scary bass.
Yeah. Just picture a wrestler and being like, oh my God, these guys are crazy. Look at them. But it's equivalent of, like, if you saw a horror movie when you were 12 and were scared, but now you watch and you're like, you look at the cover, like, their guitars aren't even plugged in. Like, this is fake. But having said that, their message meant a lot to me, and became...
What was that message exactly, Tom?
Oh, everybody sucks. The world sucks.
Which to me is a better message than another song about Ronald Reagan, the plight of Native Americans. Not that those things weren't important.
Nothing wrong with that.
But it's very hard, I think, to be effective in that situation. I think that was the downfall of the Dead Kennedys.
Yeah,
who were so great when they came out of the gate.
Yeah.
And I was with Reagan Youth. We did the whole Rock Against Reagan tour in 1984. Yeah. I was with them on the bus. And, man, the Dead Kennedys could really whip a crowd into a frenzy. Yeah, yeah. It was so exciting. And talking about great guitaring and a band that had their own sound and their own thing. Mm-hmm. But at some point, singing about Cowboy Ronnie Comes to Town, wow. No. You know what?
And Jello has never given up that ghost. Jello, I don't know if you've seen him recently.
Well, yeah, I saw him in Austin a few weeks ago at Fun Fun Fun, and I was just like, "This, no offense, whatever." He did a lot.
No offense to who? Jello?
Yeah.
Jello doesn't get offended.
Jello, you give spoken word a bad name, Biafra?
No, more like it just seemed like he could probably in 30 years from now still do those same songs and just like, I am President Obama. Just press a button. It was all the same songs, but just like...
Well, there was irony in their first record, though.
Yeah,
Kill the poor and stealing people's mail. It was important, but it was a playfulness to it.
Yeah,
that they lost, by the time...
Quickly.
Very quickly.
I interviewed him a few times, and the first time I interviewed him, we went to this Indian restaurant, and he was pouring this green shit into his water.
I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, I was like, oh, what's that? He goes, don't write that down. Please don't write that down. I'm like...
The green shit in the water?
You're not, like, green. Shooting up. You're putting, like, spirulina or in your water.
It's like Dave and Surgeon, I think he's. Well, we went to college together. I met Dave at NYU, and Dave was already a blossoming hippie. You know, this is like the internal conflict. You know, the dilemma of Dave was hippie punk, and realized you could be both because they really weren't that far apart when he came right down.
Yeah.
But Dave's dream was like to pick up a girl at the salad bar. And then later when we were roommates for a little while, they kind of crashed at my house one Saturday night, and then stayed all summer, pretty much until it became a point like, dude, keep your meat away from my tahini sauce.
Speaking of Dave,
let's take a break.
Yeah.
Let's go back, way back. Let's hear some Reagan Youth. This is Degenerated, which spawned how many bands? One. All right, you're listening to Arts and Seizures here on Heritage Radio Network.
Cool. This is Big Dad. I want to see my boy. Anybody see my boy? No. Hey, my goddamn daughter's missing too. Big Dad coming out.
Yo, man, he cut out with that D and that chick. He cut out with the D and the chick, man.
Give me another
bag. I was a teenager.
Watch out, dude.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future. giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
We do want everybody to remember that Heritage Radio is listener-supported, so please log on to heritageradionetwork.org. You probably are if you're tuned in, and send us your money and keep it going. Because this thing is going to live longer than you, Judy McGuire. You've got two more shows left. But I've got a whole lifetime here at Heritage Radio. All right, the pizza's here. We're talking to Tony Rettman about punk rock, New York hardcore. Yes. Question.
Yes.
Where does punk rock end and hardcore begin?
Ooh, well then. You know, I've kind of, obviously, I've thought about that because I think the main reason, you know, I think that first wave of New York hardcore, like the Heart Attacks, Undead things, I think those guys from D.C. or something, or Boston, had beef or an issue with that. I think because New York started punk rock, and then hardcore is supposed to be something that wiped the slate clean even of punk rock. Like, it was just like, everything sucks, everything we do is great. So,
Boys and their beefs.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a whole other radio show.
Well, you know, I think what we just heard, Reagan Youth, that was that sounded like punk rock.
No,
to
yeah, totally.
You know, I mean, it was edging towards the thrash, to the velocity, but the spirit of it sounded like it was coming from the Ramones. Also, of course, Reagan Youth, one of the great Queens band.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
Like most of the New York Dolls and the Ramones.
Yeah.
But to me, that was like more of a punk rock thing. And it's one reason I think people liked it and they could have put a finger out the hardcore kids.
Yeah.
It's because they didn't play at 12,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit funnier than serious. Even though it was like serious about,
there was no straight edge.
Yeah, there was no. Oh, Jesus Christ! They're like the most stonedest guy of all time.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying at the break. Was, you know, I was very, 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 very straight edge, and the one
were
time
you 12, could you really be anything but? Like,
I was straight edge up until I was at least I kept. Kept the law in mind. I was straight edge up until about 21.
Okay.
So, like,
you know,
like,
and then the wheels fall off the car.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. Let the wheels fall off and burn.
Because when I was 14, I couldn't wait to get laid and do drugs.
And then
finally, when I was 38 and it happened.
Well, seeing I was both scared of drugs and girls, probably up until I was 21, it all made sense.
It worked out.
But I remember the one time I saw Reagan Youth was in Thompson Square Park, and, you know, it was a pot benefit or a pot rally, and all my friends were like, I'm not going to that. And I just wanted to see Reagan Youth, and they were great. But I remember at the end, like, some guy just getting on and being like, we're going to march now, like, for pot. And I was like, hell no, I'm not. How dare you, sir?
Like, yeah, it was probably like Aaron Kay or Dana Beale, like, two of the biggest advertisements for don't do drugs.
Well, Dave was very involved with what was sort of like the last gasp of the Yippies.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was going on at number 9 Bleecker Street.
Yeah.
Which is an important part of New York City history.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Dave was in tune with that. I think, you know, a lot of the hardcore bands, too, let's not forget, there's a suburban influence on all of this.
Yeah.
First of all, it's too hard to be in a band in New York City.
Yeah.
It's impossible to rehearse. It's impossible to have a drum set.
Yeah.
It's impossible to play loud if you live in an apartment.
Yeah.
And where are you going to do it? So it's easier for kids who played in their basements to come to CBGB's and play.
Yeah.
And it sort of came out of a world. And the same thing is, I think, why also Black Flag and Orange County bands, you know, it's a suburban thing. There were many more bands, and they could get better faster because it was easier. There was no barrier to entry like there is in New York City.
Yeah.
It's just fucking hard. It's hard doing anything in New York.
Yeah.
Well,
but we don't have cars.
Back then
they had
station
wagons.
It was a little easier because there was abandoned buildings and loft spaces and stuff. But how did you pick the bands? Like, how did you pick 1980 to 90? Because I know there are people who still think hardcore is around today.
Well, it is.
I guess.
It is.
I know it is. Okay, I'm just.
I mean, you know, you can. It is.
Why did you
play Beethoven and Mozart?
That
because I know, that's what I know.
Good answer.
Because from the 80 to, you know, I was more part of it from like 85 for the second half.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always super intrigued, and it was almost like, you know, my, like I said, I had a brother. He was bringing home fanzines, bringing home records, and I wasn't really allowed to go to those shows until later. So it was almost like comic books to me. Like, I would read fanzines and look at these records, and all the records that were coming from New York weren't like Minor Threat, or they weren't like SSD Control. They looked a little more punk. And then...
and a little more fun.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was this whole thing, then it all became hard. Like, everything was hard. And then
so hard. So are you hard enough? How hard are you?
So there was a big thing there where I was like, well, how did it go from that to that? Like, I was always really super interest in that. Like, you know, like you would look at Maxim Rock and Roll and it would be like pictures of the False Prophets or something like that. But then the next issue would be like The Abused or something like that, where it's just like, well, look, these don't add up. I always thought that was weird. So I always wanted to find out kind of what that those first 5 years were. I kind of knew what the last five were. Like, that was kind of where I did a fanzine and interviewed all these bands, like, you know, that, you know, you probably think suck. Like, you know, like Gorilla Biscuits and Youth of Today and Sick of It All. Like, that was kind of my, that was my era. That's where I latched onto it. And that kind of became a part of it.
I liked those bands, though. And what I liked about, like, Sick of It All, you know, and some of those other bands of that era was the spirit of high energy and fun. And wasn't overly introspective.
Yeah.
You know, where it later became like navel-gazing indie rock.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you, when I played in high school and I was kind of like into punk rock and I was also into blues and playing in these blues bands in someone's backyard was pleasant. But when you played at a punk rock show and people started jumping up and down and people in the audience were putting off as much energy as the band was and responding to it, that's what I wanted to do. And that's why I went full, you know, full on into, you know, hardcore and thrash and, well, it's kind of an art-damaged version of it with Darkie's Machine. But I wanted to see people leaping off of PA stacks.
Yeah.
Because it turned me on. It was hot being a drummer and playing fast and hard and not, you know, moping around behind a moping around
and
singer.
People watching you. Yeah.
No. There was a shift, though, like as a woman at these shows, where in the beginning, like the mosh pit was something that you could be part of or at least on the sidelines. And then it just went so aggressively macho, sort of homoerotic, like football players tackling each other. Like, it kind of sucked. The girls, you know, it's like the Kathleen Hanna thing, like girls to the front. The, like, girls had to go to the back because otherwise, like, you'd get a boot in your face, which I did several times.
You were like the Rosa Parks of punk rock.
I would not make that joke this week. It's not a good week for that kind of stuff, I don't think.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
Did I just get told?
Yes, you did.
But you were a pioneer. I was going to ask you, though, seriously, in all seriousness, what it was like being a woman on that scene, because it is such a boys' club, and the XY vibe is so heavy on that thing. And I'll tell you what it's like.
Getting punched in the face by your boyfriend in front of CBGBs, and the only person who says something is another woman. You know, that's what it was like, not to be like a complete downer.
No, but yuck. And that's
it was like
part
a really macho, sexist thing. And, you know, after a while, I didn't want to go see those shows anymore. I didn't want to sit in the back. I still like to be at the front of the show, you know. And I just want to know when that shift was. I'm trying to think, like maybe 83?
Yeah. It seemed like from doing whatever, the research and interviews, it does seem like there was a shift somewhere. And maybe that's when there was younger people coming, like maybe people from the suburbs coming in and, you know, sort of seeing the cues from other scenes like, oh, well, like, they're tough and, you know, but I don't know. You know?
I think there definitely was a shift, too. And I think part of it, too, is like the first wave of bands that were genuinely clever and really good bands. We're talking also the L.A. bands, the Circle Jerks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty sharp record, you know, and what Black Flag was doing, what the Kennedys were doing up in San Francisco and a couple of other bands. The Dicks were great, you know, out of Texas. Mm-hmm.
And they had a gay front man.
Wearing a tutu.
You know,
it was unbelievable. Dicks were awesome.
And the big boys, too.
You know, and these bands. And then later, like every other scene, the barrier to entry gets, you know, sort of goes away. Yeah. And what you're listening to is like a third generation copy of Fast Part, Mosh Part, Fast Part, Mosh Part. And the band stopped being as sharp and clever. You didn't have to be as sharp and clever because it became a thing. And more and more people became attracted to it, and the scene became more gentrified, if you will, meaning at first punk rock is about being an individual, and then it became about being a gang and looking like everybody else.
Yeah. No, it's true, yeah.
I mean, the first guy you saw with a circled A was like, whoa, that guy's kind of like out there, he's an outlaw.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you knew, they were selling it in St. Mark's Place.
Yeah. But that's also the weird thing is, like, I think for that later part of hardcore, whatever you want to call it, like, when those bands like Black Flag or the Dead Kennedys started to grow a little, like, I remember seeing Black Flag many times where a bunch of, you know, young dudes with their heads shaved would be like, hey, what's this? Like, didn't you buy a record? Like, don't you know? This is, like, not what it was in 1982. And they would just be so like, hey, this guy sold out. Like, really? Are you paying
Black Flag?
You just paid $10 for this. Like, you know, like, I know what I was getting into. Why didn't you? Like, that was a really weird thing where there was just, like, a lot of bands that sort of went further, but the audience stayed back.
I want to say before we go, congratulations to me on the cover of The Village Voice. That was amazing that this book and your book and the story was on the cover of The Village Voice last week.
Yeah.
I mean, that was more coverage than they gave it at the time that it was actually happening.
Really? That's what everybody said, I mean, actually, it's Freddie from Madball that's on the cover. But, yeah, no, we – that – I had nothing. And a lot of people asked me, like, well, how'd you do that? I was like, I didn't do anything. Like, it's not like I went to somebody's log cabin with a sifter of cognac. I was like, so let's talk about this.
Oh, is
like,
it
didn't happen.
Well,
like,
well, if it were the Village Voice, you'd probably have to go to Phoenix where their headquarters are.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
but is it possible that the people who are now running the Village Voice and are in power came out of the scene? I mean,
they did.
And because at the time, I mean, again, it was a youth movement.
Yeah.
And it's not a thing that necessarily needed to be take. I mean, I say that weird because Taylor Swift's on the cover of Time magazine this week, and it doesn't get any more teeny bopper than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was not happening in serious music circles, this hardcore punk thing. It was a real DIY, grassroots, street-fed movement, and it was huge. It was powerful.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think so. I think that's the deal. Is now it's gotten up to that point where the people who are in charge were actually a part of it back then. And
so, where can people find your book? Because your website is down now. Your Bazillion Points Books is down.
What?
Well, I don't know if it's down. Basically, it's the book had more legs than we thought. Let's just say
that. Okay. Oh, that's great. You crashed.
You've been crashed for unbelievable amount of traffic.
But you can still order it. I think the next batch will go out to the end of December. It's www.nyhcbook.com, or you can go to the Bazillion Points site.
And that's a great URL. NYHCbook.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's it. New York
hardcore
book.
Pretty easy.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, as ever, it has been like a good hardcore show, the fastest half hour in entertainment. So, Judy McGuire, two more shows.
Two more shows.
We're counting it down. Next week, this week punk rock. Next week booze.
Oh, right. I forgot to do booze. All right.
So we're going out.
You know,
with
the Irish lady likes that.
Yeah, so we're going out with your favorite topics, and we're heading into Christmas. Tony Rettman, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on your book. It is entirely awesome. Thanks to Liz in the booth. For Judy McGuire, this is Mike Edison. We'll see you next week on Arts and Seizures.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.